Almost everyone who has toured Israel has been taken to Capernaum, Kfar Nahum, the village of Nahum. It lies, as you know, on the north shore of the Sea of Galilee. Capernaum was, during Roman times and earlier, a thriving town, which lay on one of the major caravan routes from the Euphrates River in Syria to the Mediterranean coast. It was one of those important stops along the way where tired caravaneers could refresh themselves, have a good fish dinner from the sea, and it became quite a commercial center. Today, no one lives at Kfar Nahum. It's an archaeological site. The only building there which is occupied is a Franciscan monastery, which was built there sometime after 1897, when a group of French Franciscan monks bought what was called then Tel Chum and built there this monastery. Now, why did they buy Tel Chum? Because Tel Chum was traditionally associated with Capernaum. And Capernaum is perhaps, next to Jerusalem, the most important city or town associated in the New Testament with the life of Jesus. Jesus, according to the New Testament, you recall, is born in several places, but basically in Nazareth. And early on in his youth, according to the story, he and his family moved to Capernaum. Capernaum by the Sea, it's called in New Testament, which is the only town which is called his home. It's there that he performs a number of those faith-healing miracles which establish him as a creditable, charismatic figure. He is described in New Testament as having performed the miracle of the fish and the loaves of bread at Capernaum and having spoken a number of times in its synagogue. He returns to Capernaum after his first visit to Jerusalem. It's, in other words, it's the center of his ministry in the Galilee. It's also, according to the New Testament, the home where of Peter and of Simon, two of his very important disciples. And so it was only natural, as a matter of piety, that the good Franciscans would settle there. And they've been engaged ever since in organizing the tourist trade and the archaeological research of the place. And one of the first things that they discovered at Capernaum was the remains of a synagogue, a very large basilica-type synagogue, which in the early part of the century was pointed out as the very synagogue in which Jesus preached, but which was quickly dated to at least the second or third century, in other words, 100 years or more after his death. But it remains one of the very beautiful pieces of building on the site. And in 1922, the Franciscans ordered a restoration of this synagogue. And when you visit there, as many of you have, you've seen the tall columns of the sanctuary, the Corinthian columns on one side of the sanctuary, the porch to its west. And it's a very, very moving and impressive building, the largest of its kind. In recent years, as the Franciscans have done further research on that site, they discovered underneath the floor of this synagogue, which had been dated to the second or third century, remains of an older city, and buried there several hoards of coins, which had been placed in the foundations of the synagogue from the third and fourth century with the figures of Constans and a number of the other Eastern Roman emperors. And so the synagogue is now generally dated somewhat even later. But for Jews then, it's one of the great synagogue sites, early synagogue sites in Israel. For Christians then, it's part of the Holy Land, retrace the steps of Jesus' tour. And almost everybody who comes to Israel is taken to this very beautiful site on the shore of the sea. Now, why mention it this morning? Because as you walk with your guide along the pathways around the synagogue at Capernaum, you'll be shown pieces of sculpted stone which come from the frieze of the building. One of the, you'll see a stone which is carved like a palm tree, another stone which has the shape of the Kansas leaf, another large stone image of two bullocks drawing a cart on which there's a box, which is obviously a reference to the biblical story of how the ark was carried from place to place in Israel before it was finally placed in the temple in Jerusalem. And you'll also be shown, as part of this frieze, a stone which has the six-pointed star, the hexagram, on it. Those two overlaid equilateral triangles, which we now call the Star of David, and associate as the great symbol of the Jewish people. And I've heard, as I've been in Capernaum a number of times, any number of guides who use this Magen David, this image of the Star of David, as proof that this building was, in fact, a synagogue. Now, there's no doubt that it was a synagogue, but the six-pointed star does not prove that it was a synagogue. As a matter of fact, if you look to the next stone but one over, you'll see that in that same frieze, there was, in addition to the six-pointed star, a five-pointed star, and more interestingly, the next image is that of a swastika. And the image of the swastika hardly proves that the building is, in fact, a synagogue. These are simply decorative designs that were common throughout West Asia, taken over probably from designs which were devised and used architecturally first in India and in Persia in earlier times yet. Now, I want to take you from Israel to Italy. I want to take you from Capernaum to the Uffizi Gallery in Florence, and I want to take you from, say, the first century or the fourth century of this era down to the Renaissance, down to the 14th century, 1,000 years in time, 500 miles in space from Israel to Italy. And when you visit the Uffizi and you go into the early Renaissance galleries, you'll see across one of the galleries a very large, very brilliant altarpiece, which shows you the drama of the crucifixion. And if you look carefully at this altarpiece, the painter is unknown, you'll see not only, if you look, it's beyond the three execution poles, the two criminals and Jesus on the cross, and you look down below at the figures on the ground level, you'll see various onlookers, and you'll also see the Roman soldiers who are busy with the business of execution. And if you look closely at the soldiers, you'll see that each one bears a shield, and that on each of these shields there's a single symbol, the Magen David, the hexagram, the six-pointed star. So clearly, to a good, pious Roman Catholic painter of the Renaissance, the Star of David was not a symbol of Jews. He could use it as a symbol of the Romans. He probably used it simply because it fit in with his design. But what I'm saying is that even by the Middle Ages, there was no association as yet of the Star of David with the Jewish people. Now come a few thousand miles west and come down to our time, and imagine yourself in the one place I'm sure you've all been, in the main sanctuary of our temple, main temple. And I hope you're observant. And you've paused at one time or another, not only to look at the magnificent ark and the altar and the dome, but you've looked at the wood carvings that are on the frieze of the balcony. If you've looked carefully at those wood carvings, there are four sections to the balcony, and each of these sections has in it five carvings, five medallions in raised relief. The center three medallions in each of the four sections of the balcony show the traditional symbols one by one of the 12 tribes of Israel. The bracketing medallions in each balcony, the edge medallions in each balcony, have in it a seal which the good fathers and mothers of the temple determined to be the seal of the temple, I think at the time when the main temple was built in the early 1920s. And that seal, if you've ever looked at it, consists of a menorah, a seven-branch candelabrum, overlaid by the Star of David, the six-pointed star, all this banded by two concentric circles, one inside the other. And I did a little research, and I went back into the minutes of the temple, and I discovered that they understood this symbol to be the menorah, the light of faith, the light of learning, The star, the six-pointed star of David, was to be faith in action. The inner band, the inner circle, was to be the unity of the Jewish people. The outer band was to be the unity of all peoples. And these were to be the guiding principles of the congregation. And you can hardly go anywhere today, which is associated with Jewish life, and not see the six-pointed star. I remember years ago here in Cleveland on Memorial Day, when you would drive down along North Park Boulevard and Liberty Boulevard towards the lake, each of those trees had been dedicated to one of the soldiers who had died in the First World War. And there were little white crosses for the Christian soldiers, and there was a white Star of David raised every Memorial Day for the Jewish soldiers who had been killed. And still today, in an American cemetery, that's the indication of the religion of a soldier who is buried there. If you look at the flag of the State of Israel on a blue and white background, you'll see the six-pointed star. When Israel wanted to have a sign for its voluntary service agency, it didn't want to call it the Red Cross, so it called it the Red Magen David, the Magen David Adom, the red six-pointed star, and that's the symbol you'll see on ambulances and the security vehicles of that kind in Israel. So today, in recent times at least, the Star of David has become the symbol of the Jewish people, consecrated us particularly in our lifetime, when our enemies in Germany used the six-pointed star for what they called a badge of shame. It was a yellow cutout of the six-pointed star that they made the Jews of Europe wear to identify them as a, quote, badge of shame. Now, how did all this come about? It's an interesting story, because we tend to think of our people as an historic people. We tend to think of our images as traditional. And any of you who know, who've talked to me about before you've gone to abroad and said to me, I'd like to bring back an object or two for the Temple Museum, you know I've always said to you, if they try to sell you any antiquity with a Star of David on it, run, because there is no such beast. Archaeologists have now turned over a great deal of the inhabited space in ancient Israel. And in all of the findings, there's only a single object from the time of the conquest down to Roman times which has on it a six-pointed star. It's a little, tiny little seal which belonged in the 7th century before the Common Era to a man by the name of Joshua ben Ahiyasa, who lived in Sidon in what is today the Lebanon. And in addition to the engraving in Proto-Hebrew of his name, there are a number of other little vices, and there's a minuscule little six-pointed star, which does not prove he was a Jew. He may very well have been, because we know of seals from the Persian culture, from the Assyrian culture, from the Babylonian culture, which also have these various devices on them. It's simply a form of decoration. Where does a six-pointed star come from? How did it gain importance? Six-pointed star was not only a simple geometric device which architects and artists enjoyed using, but it developed early an association with magic, and it was a talisman, an amulet. We believe that this use began in Tantric Buddhism. It certainly spread through Persia, and when the people deciphered and found the parchment texts of the Egyptian books of magic, they found that any number of amulets had the six-pointed or the five-pointed star on them as a protective device. And it is as that kind of talisman or amulet. The Hebrew word, interestingly, for an amulet is kamea, from which the English word cameo, as in the brooch, comes from. And our ancestors and Christian ancestors and Muslim ancestors all used the five-pointed star and the six-pointed star as a protective device. One of the interesting facts of culture is the speed with which magic and superstition passes from culture to culture. As a rabbi, I wish that the high ideas of a culture would pass as easily from one group to another. But magic, superstition seem to have a universal quality to them. And we find the same symbol being used in all three of the Western religious cultures, or rather the underworld of the religious cultures, down and through the early centuries. It gained an importance and it gained a name largely in the Arab world, in the Muslim world. And there, this six-pointed star and also the five-pointed star, they were used interchangeably in early times, seemed to have been called not the shield of David, but the seal of Solomon. And the story goes back to a story which grew up, we know not where. It appears in the Talmud, it appears in some of the Christian patristic literature, it appears in Muslim folk literature. A story of a great battle, a battle of strength and wits between King Solomon and Ashmedai, the prince of darkness, one of the various manifestations of Satan or the devil. And they're contesting their power and their wisdom. And finally, there are various versions of this story, but finally Solomon wins out in the Talmudic version because he holds up his right hand and on his wrist is the great seal, signet ring, in which are inscribed the four letters of the Tetragrammaton, the magical, all-powerful name of God. And this silences, defeats Ashmedai. Now how this signet ring with the seal of, with a special name of God became a six-pointed star with the same kinds of power, we're not quite sure, but it did. And one we do know, interestingly, that when the six-pointed star begins to appear in Muslim magical texts and later is translated into Christian and Jewish texts of the same kind, the star is often made up not simply of lines, but of what we call micrography, that is, letters, put so closely together that unless you have a magnifying glass or remarkably good eyes, you can't make out the words. And the words turn out to be, particularly in the early Hebrew manuscripts, Hebrew names in various combinations of God. So essentially, they make the six-pointed star not out of lines, but out of the name of God, names of God. There were 72 all-powerful names. And these become a shield for a woman to wear during childbirth against Lilith, who is the great force of evil, of danger, for a house to protect itself against fire. In the Middle Ages, it became customary in Europe for Jews who inscribed mezuzot, the door symbol of our tradition, not only to put into the mezuzah the various portions from the Torah which are inscribed there, the Shema, the Vahavta, but also to surround the parchment with five and six-pointed stars, which were supposedly guaranteed shields against fire, which was the most common and most feared of all the dangers that a householder had to face in those days. In any case, we know that this particular symbol was extremely popular in the Arab world because it was precisely from the Arab world in areas which the Arabs had once conquered that you begin to see the six-pointed star move over into the Christian world particularly. There are three great 12th, 13th century cathedrals in Spain, at Burgos, at Lerida, and Valladolid, all of which have over the arch of the central portal a great six-pointed star. And in Anagni in southern Italy, in the 12th century, the episcopal prince of the bishop of the town had a great stone throne carved so he could sit in power during his service. And the throne is not at all unusual, except that it is surmounted by a giant round stone carving, which is that of the six-pointed star, a symbol that he has the protective power to give to his people, to protect them from all that is evil. And it's true also that in Hebrew manuscripts, the first manuscripts which use the six-pointed star as decoration or with the names of God are those which appear in the Arab world and are then from there brought into Europe. So that what we have is the seal of Solomon as a five-pointed star or a six-pointed star, part of the magical underground, the superstitious underground of our religious tradition, of the Christian religious tradition, of Islam, as part of the give and take of that magical, mystical world. Still no identification with the Jewish people. The portals at Burgos and Valladolid and Lerida are much earlier by a factor of five, six centuries than any use of the Star of David in a Jewish synagogue or a sign of a Jewish synagogue. Now, how did this change all take place? First of all, how did the seal of David become a seal of Solomon become the seal or the shield of David? The answer seems to be that this transformation was accomplished in the 14th and 15th centuries by the Christian alchemists of Europe. Alchemy, remember, is a kind of pre-science where men were attempting to transform baser metals into gold to find the secrets of the universe so that they could, in fact, bring about messianic times through human effort. And they were great classifiers. The material that they wrote is absolute nonsense. But they were classifiers. They tried to put everything in its form. And they used the five-pointed star and the six-pointed star as symbols of the way the cosmos was put together. And they tried on the basis of its proportions and all kinds of Kabbalistic things of this kind to create the equations which would accomplish their purposes. And they needed to classify the five-pointed star separate from the six-pointed star. And for reasons of their own, they called the five-pointed star the Seal of Solomon and the six-pointed star the Seal of David. And we don't know quite why they did that, but it was done. Now, the Jews had, interestingly, their own tradition of a Magen David, of a Seal of David. It had nothing to do with the six-pointed star. It had to do, as a matter of fact, with the menorah, the great symbol of the temple of Messianic times. Beginning in the 13th and 14th century, particularly a little later, we find the kind of design which I placed here before you. This is a late 19th century mizrach, the kind of symbol which was placed on the wall of a synagogue to indicate the direction of Jerusalem, in the west, direction east. And you'll see that the central design is that, in color, is that of the menorah, the seven-branch candlestick. But I hope you'll come up after the service and look more closely, because if you do, you'll see that all around the menorah are Hebrew letters. And the Hebrew letters are the text of the 67th Psalm. And for reasons which we're not quite sure of, sometime in the early part of this millennium, around the 13th to 14th centuries, the Jews came to believe that the words of the 67th Psalm had particular powers to protect them, to shield them from evil. And they created this menorah design made out of the letters as an amulet which would protect them. Now, the Psalm's a very simple one. God be gracious unto us and bless us. May God cause his face to shine toward us. May his way always be known upon earth, his salvation among all nations. Let the peoples give thanks unto thee, O God. Let the peoples give thanks unto thee, all of them. O let the nations be glad and sing for joy. For thou wilt judge the peoples with equity and lead the nations upon earth. Let the people give thanks unto thee, O God. Let the people give thanks unto thee, all of them. The earth has yielded her increase. May God, our own God, bless us. May God bless us. And all the ends of the earth fear him. The text, you can understand how it somehow became a symbol of that which has the power to shield. And this was the original Magen David, and is known in texts of all kinds of that. The text will say, David carried on his shield the sign of the menorah, written out of the 67th Psalm. And as long as he considered the words of his psalm, he and his troops were victorious, and they were safe. And we find that again and again in the medieval literature. Now, how did the Magen David move over from the menorah to the Star of David? Again, that's an interesting story, only part of which we can yet put together. But it seems that in the year 1357, and I now take you from Israel to Italy to the United States, and I've got to go back to Czechoslovakia with you. I take you to Prague. In 1357, the Emperor Charles II gave the Jews of Prague a signal boon. He was very pleased with them. They supported him in his struggles against the King of Hungary and against the invading Turks, and he was very grateful to the community. So he said to the community, from now on, you are allowed to have a banner, a flag of your own. Now, we don't know what was on that flag. But we do know that 200 years later, in the middle of the 16th century, another Habsburg emperor, Ferdinand II, came to Prague, and the Jews came out to meet him bearing their flag. And someone has described that flag and said that the symbol that was on it was a six-pointed star. Now, we don't know whether some king assigned to the Jews this star or the Jews chose it for themselves. If it was assigned to the Jews, it was a sign that we were somehow identified with magic and superstition. If we chose it for ourselves, it was somehow chosen because of its association with the power to shield, to protect from any evil that might occur. But we don't know how it happened. What we do know is that beginning in the 16th century, we begin here, there, in Czechoslovakia and Moravia and Hungary to find the Star of David associated with a Jewish Hevra Kedisha, a burial society. We find it in the ironwork of a 16th century Moravian synagogue around the Bima, the central pulpit. Increasingly, it becomes simply a symbol of that this place is somehow Jewish. Now, what happened in the 16th century? The spread of printing, the spread of books. And as books spread, there needs to be the symbol of a country, a symbol of a faith. And increasingly, Jews chose, for whatever reason, to use this emblem from the flag of the community of Prague. And it becomes associated in the 18th century, particularly with all kinds of Jewish organizations and all kinds of Jewish communities. The spread is very rapid. We're really now in the beginning of our own age, where we operate less with words and more with symbols. Every religion has its symbol. Western Christianity, the cross. Eastern Catholicism, this double cross. The cross with one vertical this way, one horizontal this way, and one at an angle. Islam, the crescent. Israel, Judaism, the six-pointed star. Now, the six-pointed star still has no religious significance whatsoever. It is simply chosen as an emblem, a symbol to the outside world. And we owe a great deal of the popularity of the six-pointed star, not only to this fact that people want a shorthand way of symbolizing Jews and Christians and Muslims, but to the fact that in the late 19th century, Theodor Herzl fell in love with a six-pointed star. We're not quite sure why, but the first newspaper he published as a Zionist organ was called Die Welt, the world, and the symbol on the masthead is the six-pointed star. And at the first Zionist Congress in 1897 in Basel, Theodor Herzl got the delegates there to accept the six-pointed star as the official emblem of the Zionist movement. Now, he was opposed in this. A number of men got up at that conference and said, this is a superstitious symbol, a pagan symbol. It doesn't belong at all in Jewish life. But the six-pointed star had an advantage to Herzl, besides the fact that he liked its symmetry. I don't know what he particularly liked about it. He never explains that in his diary. But it had the virtue of not offending anyone's sensibilities besides those who were so proper they didn't want to be associated with superstition. No Orthodox Jew or traditional Jew objected to the six-pointed star being used by Zionists because, unlike the menorah, it was not associated with the messianic dreams. No one in Jewish life up to the 19th century had ever seriously speculated on the mystical meaning of the six-pointed star. It offended no one that the Zionists should use it. And so they used it. And of course, it became therefore associated with the whole movement to rejuvenate Jewish life through the reestablishment of a Jewish state. And as it became the symbol of Zionism to Jews, it became the symbol of a resurging sense of peoplehood to non-Jews. And those who had hate for us began to think of us in terms of the menorah, of the Magen David. And we became associated with it, and we were made to wear the badge of shame out of this very design. And of course, the Nazi experience, the Holocaust, consecrated for us the Star of David as a symbol. Now, what's the message in all of this, besides the fact it's fascinating history? The first is, of course, that you can save a few dollars if you go into a shop and they show you something with a Magen David on it, and you tell them it's not old. If you like it, buy it if it's new, but don't buy it because it's old. But more importantly, the popularity of symbols of this kind suggests the changes which have taken place in the very nature of self-identification. The identification of groups. One of the reasons the Nazis forced Jews to wear a six-pointed star on their garments is you couldn't tell a Jew from a non-Jew without some external symbol of this kind. We look like everybody else. The German Jews spoke German. They shared German culture. They'd been part of the German educational system. You simply cannot separate Jew from non-Jew on the basis of physiognomy, on the basis of the Germans' claim of race. We have become truly a pluralistic world. Now, in olden times, custom, language, dress, all those were symbols which were natural ways of identifying a particular group. These increasingly fail. And the more they fail, the more the group begins to identify itself with a certain symbol, and the more the group is identified by outsiders by that symbol. And so, in a sense, the popularity of the Star of David for Jews is one that it provides us a rallying point. It can be worn around the neck. It can be used in the flag of the Jewish state. It can be used on the stationery of a congregation or a welfare federation or a Jewish agency. It's a means of quick identification which says you, this is unser uns, among us. This is part of our world. And for the outside people, if they gain control over us or of any group, it's a way of stigmatizing, of separating out, of creating the division between, when in fact, culturally, linguistically, and otherwise, these divisions no longer exist as they once did. And there you have the Magen David. It's a simple design. It is now forever burnt into the soul of the Jewish people. It is from now on out, it will be the great symbol of peoplehood. And interestingly, in the 20th century, we have the first attempt to create a theology, to create a philosophy of Jewish life based on the symbolism of the Magen David. You don't find it among the Kabbalists, you don't find it among the medieval philosophers, you don't find it among the Hasidim. You find it only in a rationalist 20th century German Jew named Franz Rosenzweig, who early on in this century used the Star of David to try and describe his, what he called, process theology. He wrote a book called The Star of Redemption. And he said in that book that you have two equilateral triangles. One of the triangles represents creation, redemption, and revelation, the divine things. One represents man, the universe, and the Jewish world. And that the relationships between these points, which are never together, they're not one. He was against all attempts to create a sense of philosophic unity. But the relationships, the meetings of these various points, are the ways in which Jews have traditionally identified themselves. A very thick, almost impenetrable German bit of philosophic writing. Interesting today, not for my trying to explain it to you, because I'm not, but simply because it's the first attempt in all of Jewish history to give a philosophic meaning to the Star of David. It really has none. It is simply a symbol of Jewish rejuvenation, of Jewish identity, of the confusions among Jews and non-Jews in our world about what it means to be Jewish. Amen.